Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary health care services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with Lynn Quincy, Senior Policy Analyst for Health Reform at Consumers Union. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare reports on a new device that provides instant tissue analysis. And we begin with this week's bright idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. For anyone who's lost weight, you know that counting calories taken in versus calories burned off is just part of the equation. Quite simply, it's imperative that you do the math if you're going to drop the weight. It turns out it could be the best tool for guiding public policy to help populations lose weight, especially when it comes to the nation's children, a third of whom are obese or overweight. Researchers at Columbia University have come up with a system that could help school districts plan for the diet and exercise needs of student populations. The Caloric Calculator is the brainchild of Columbia public health researcher Dr. Claire Wong, who developed this online tool for policymakers and school administrators to do the math for an entire student population.
Our goal is to empower the community, local governments and parents and the school district teachers and principals to say, okay, there are a lot of things we could do as teachers or as a community, and they will have different impact. And the tool is creating a common metric to measure what is the relative impact of different approaches.
She says the idea is to assess the group's weight loss needs and offer simple mathematical suggestions for serving kids lower calorie foods and increasing their daily exercise, using a scientific formula that will, over time, lead to weight loss across the student population. Juan says the Caloric Counter, which anyone can access at caloriccounter.org, is designed with two goals in mind: help public policy officials design programs to impact the growing childhood obesity epidemic, but more importantly, perhaps prevent future cases of childhood obesity, which can compromise a child's health permanently.
We're focusing on prevention, meaning how do we change things in their daily lives so if they can be more active, either through individual level behavioral changes or something more population level or community level, such as adding school PE time.
The Caloric Counter was just rolled out in August as part of the federal government's Healthy People 2020 initiative, which hopes to bring current childhood obesity rates down to 15% by the end of the decade. An online tool to arm policymakers and school administrators to tackle childhood obesity on a grander scale. Now that's a bright idea. We're speaking today with Lynn Quincy, Senior Policy Analyst for Health Reform at Consumers Union, the Advocacy and Public Policy Division of Consumer Reports, an independent nonprofit organization dedicated to ensuring a fair, safe, and just marketplace for all consumers. Ms. Quincy is an expert in a wide variety of health policy issues and recently released an in-depth report on the importance of choice architecture in the design of web portals for health insurance exchanges, which are being created around the country under the Affordable Care Act. Ms. Quincy, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, thank you, Mark. I'm very pleased to be on this important program.
That's great. You know, the nation's health reform law is about to bring tens of millions of Americans into the insurance rolls by 2014, many of whom will be navigating online health insurance exchanges to purchase their insurance. And before we get to your report on choice architecture, let's take a look at the idea of health insurance exchanges. Seems to be a lot of confusion among consumers as well as states who are charged with setting up these exchanges. So what are they? How do they work? And why are insurance exchanges such an important element of the Affordable Care Act? And if you will, how will it work in those states who refuse to set up their own exchanges?
Well, these are excellent questions, and it's always hard to get your arms around something that you can't see yet. Here's how consumers should think about exchanges. They're an online marketplace where you can go and buy health insurance. And in that way, they're kind of like the online travel agencies that we use today. But they're actually better than that for a couple reasons. First of all, exchanges are nonprofit entities that are established to serve the public interest. And that's really good for consumers. Just as an example, it means that a health plan couldn't pay to be listed first among the choices. You won't see that type of thing. Furthermore, all the plans that are sold in these exchanges will be qualified by either the state or the federal government, and that gives confidence to consumers. As another example, you couldn't go to the exchange and inadvertently buy a plan that had a lot of hidden loopholes. So that's really nice for consumers. But most importantly, it's only plans that are sold in the exchanges that are eligible for the new premium tax credits that start in 2014. You can use these tax credits to make coverage more affordable, and we all know there's millions of consumers that are in that position where they need some help with the affordability of their coverage. One of the things that you asked about is states that aren't setting up their own exchanges, mm-hmm. and the law has a fallback. The federal government will operate the exchange in any state that is not going to set up their own exchange, and it will do so in partnership with the state so that, you know, that exchange reflects what's going on in that state. We, consumer groups such as my own, check in with these federal regulators periodically, and I know they're hard at work. So consumers in every state should have an exchange option when open enrollment begins October 1st, 2013.
Well, Lynn, you've been conducting some in-depth analysis of how choice architecture of these online exchanges is really vital to consumers making the right decisions when they purchase their healthcare plans. And I know your team at Consumers Union was inspired to look into this area after the book about choice architecture called Nudge suggested just how important this is for consumers. Maybe for our listeners, you could explain what you mean by this concept of choice architecture.
Choice architecture refers to how your choices are structured. And the book Nudge really popularized this concept. And what the book said is, if you can keep the underlying choices the same, but mix up how they're presented, and in doing so, you really influence the ultimate selection made by the consumer. So the way in which your choices are structured turns out to be really powerful, and marketers have figured this out, but it's sort of time for policymakers and even exchange designers to step up to the plate and understand this tool that they've been handed.
You know, let's talk a little bit about that, and you've been thinking about behavioral economics of buying health insurance. And it's a daunting and complicated task for even informed consumers. And now with the individual mandate, more of the population will be buying their policy online. And as a consumer advocacy organization, you've given a lot of thought as to how consumers should be considered in this area of choice architecture. Why is it so difficult, so complicated for consumers to make the right choice when it comes to buying health insurance?
Health insurance is a very complicated product. The consumer testing that we conducted shows that consumers understand the basic trade-off between how much premium they pay and how much coverage they get, but they're very frustrated because it is actually almost impossible for them to assess one side of that equation, which is how much coverage am I getting? In order to get to sort of a bottom line, you'd have to have a way of rolling up a whole bunch of discrete plan features like the deductible, the copay, the patient's out-of-pocket limits. And in today's world, it is pretty much impossible. It's simply too big a cognitive task. And as a consumer organization, we feel that's simply unfair when you're talking about a product that's this expensive and is also vital to the financial and medical health of families. One thing that I might want to clarify is while many people will be purchasing on the exchange in 2014 online, there's going to be lots of non-online options. And I just don't want your listeners to feel like that will be the only shopping avenue open to them. They can still talk to live human beings and so on and so forth.
Good point.
You know, Lynn, it reminds me of when Medicare D first came on the scene. You can imagine that was a daunting process for millions of seniors around the country. Maybe shed some more light for the consumer on what they're going to have to do if they do choose to go online and enroll in insurance. What do you envision the step-by-step process to be? And concurrently with that, what is the education outreach campaign that states are expected to produce to make sure that people get there and are knowledgeable about how to proceed?
Well, states are required to have an outreach plan to raise consumer awareness of their new rights and their new obligations. And I think that states and the the federal government are probably going to approach this in a wide variety of ways. Let's look at some basic steps that a policymaker would have to keep in mind, or a consumer even. There's going to be a lot of competing products for those consumer eyeballs. There's going to be lookalike exchanges that are sort of scams. And there's also going to be, in most states, legitimate non-exchange websites that help consumers navigate exchange products. So a consumer has to sort of figure out, where am I even going to start? But let's say they decide that the state's done a good job with outreach. The consumer decides to go to the exchange. Exchanges have a lot of design decisions to make. And I know from talking to folks in different states, in some cases, they're going to take the approach of asking for quite a bit of upfront information from the consumer. In other cases, exchanges may say, you know, you can approach this shopping task however you want. Go ahead and browse the plans, and we'll figure out later if you got interested in a sort of a plan that you don't qualify for some reason. Once consumers are at the point where they are browsing their healthcare options, they're going to have lots of tools at their disposal. It's going to be quite robust, as best I can tell from talking to states, and consumers will be pretty happy with the navigation tools that have been provided to them.
We're speaking today with Lynn Quincy, Senior Policy Analyst for Health Reform at Consumers Union, the policy and advocacy branch of Consumer Reports. She just came out with a report, Choice Architecture, Design Decisions That Affect Consumers' Health Plan Choices, which is aimed at policymakers and insurance companies to create online health insurance portals that will be user-friendly once the insurance exchanges are up and running. Lynn, you've worked with the folks at CMS and the State of Massachusetts Health Connector. You produced this report to fill a hole in what you saw as evidence-based analysis on what's going to be the best for consumers. Give us some examples of a good plan design, a robust interactive choice architecture.
Some of the elements of a good design, a very consumer-friendly choice architecture, which again is how are those health plan choices displayed for the consumer. My top point would be that you must pay great attention to that initial default display of search results. The first time you see the list of plans that you might potentially purchase, what does that display look like? In our own research and what these other online tools told us is that many consumers never alter that display. They essentially make their decision from whatever shows up there. So things like the order in which the plans are sorted and what do you emphasize via design elements become very, very important. One of the tools we talked to is a tool called Consumers Checkbook. They're unaffiliated with Consumers Union, and they have a robust tool that's used for federal employees. Their default sort uses an estimate of what the typical family would have to pay out of pocket if they had that plan, and they actually add to it premium. So it becomes the cost of choosing that plan for a year. And it's just an estimate, but it's an amazingly powerful design decision that was made. Earlier, I said how difficult it was to figure out how much coverage is offered by a plan. And by providing this estimate of what a typical family might pay under a given plan, they've essentially done some of that work for the consumer. Secondly, the overall design should be, you should be able to navigate it intuitively. It shouldn't be something that consumers have to learn to do. They should be able to look at it and know what they need to do. And finally, there needs to be robust consumer testing before it's rolled out and then ongoing feedback once it is rolled out. And that may seem a little bit silly, but in my experience, I think a lot of entities underspend on consumer testing, which is just a very powerful way to make sure that you've done it right.
Well, Lynn, you just laid out sort of a wonderful map for people of what's a good plan design. And maybe we should ask you the reverse of that. What would be some examples of things that aren't geared to the best interest of the consumer, things that the health insurance consumer should really watch out for? And what's a system that would fail to meet the needs of the stakeholders and the consumers in this process?
Well, as we've looked at across the universe, I have a fairly long list, but I'll only mention a few. Some practices that I think are not consumer-friendly would be using a proprietary method to sort the plan search results to craft a new data point for the plan. So for example, let's say you had, you know, stars rated on customer feedback, but the consumer couldn't understand what the methodology was for creating those stars. Then they should be suspicious. I mean, it's possible This is more likely, I would say, outside the exchange in the plan chooser tools that will be out there with those alternate broker websites. The way the results are sorted is very, very powerful. And if it's sorted by something that is proprietary and you can't understand what it is, I'd say that's a red flag. I would not want to see design elements that circumvent the spirit of the law. So, for example, a website selling exchange products but is outside the exchange itself is supposed to display all the same choices that are displayed in the exchange. We have websites now that sell Medicare plans, so it's a similar sort of construct. And they might show all the plans, but only if the consumer navigates and does like 7 or 8 clicks to get to all the plans. And what that default display is just the plans for which they have the most profitable contractual arrangement. So that would be, to me, that's violating the spirit of what you're supposed to be doing and another red flag for consumers. This is true for any tool. If not all your choices are currently displayed, in other words, some are hidden, that needs to be made perfectly clear to the consumer because their default assumption is going to be that I'm looking at all my choices and I should select from among the ones that are displayed. Those are some key things that I'm going to be on the lookout for and that I'm a little worried about.
Lynn, for listeners who don't know, Consumer Union is dedicated to protecting the rights of consumers. So let's talk about the healthcare law in general. You've been consulting with the Department of Health and Human Services, meeting with members of Congress since before the health law was actually passed. You've participated in hearings, doing consumer surveys of what will be best for consumers under the Affordable Care Act. And you say that this is a very consumer-friendly bill. So let's talk about what makes this bill so consumer-friendly beyond what most of us are already aware of. Something new that's starting this month under the ACA, a new summary of coverage and benefits that's intended to provide more transparent information to the consumers. What are the requirements of this new summary, and how does this help consumers?
The summary of benefits and coverage is not well known, but it's actually a powerful consumer benefit that may even improve how health insurance markets function. The form is a standard uniform way of displaying health insurance information, like what is the deductible, what is the coinsurance, what is excluded from coverage. By having all that information displayed in a uniform way and a consumer-friendly way, consumers can now shop for health plans and line up these forms side by side and compare plans much more easily. Before the form came out, you would have to compare plans, but their information wouldn't be lined up in a standard way, and they wouldn't be using uniform definitions for things. Sort of think of it a little bit like the nutritional facts labels on food. So we consider this a wonderful step forward for consumers and long overdue.
So Lynn, as we really enter this next phase where we've gone from all the planning for the ACA to the implementation, Consumers Union really providing, I think, an incredibly important service for the country. I understand you're setting up a website for consumers to report on how their experience under the Affordable Care Act is going, and you plan to aggregate that information and make it available both to policymakers and to the public to maybe focus on what's working well and also improve problem areas that emerge. Tell us about these ongoing research plans that are really aimed at monitoring the impact of the healthcare law.
We're actually starting off a bit more narrowly focused than that. The initial monitoring effort that we're just kicking off now is specifically directed towards consumers' experience with that summary of benefits and coverage form. The Department of Health and Human Services has pledged to improve the form over time, which is typical for disclosures of this nature. And we want to provide really robust evidence to take advantage of that process that they've committed to. So we will be doing a nationally representative survey in order to understand consumers' experience with the new form. And we're also going to set up a web-based feedback collection tool. We're going to widely advertise it. Consumers can go to the website. They can fill in information about their experience with the form, or even if they never saw it when they shopped for coverage, which is a phenomenon we hope we don't see, but we're going to try to unearth if it's there. And there'll be open-ended questions to generally say how you would improve the form if it was particularly problematic and you want us to see exactly what you were looking at. So that's what we're going to do initially. And if this is successful, I hope that we will actually expand it to see how the law is working for consumers more generally.
Lynn, we'd like to ask all of our guests this final question. When you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of healthcare innovation that our listeners at Conversation should be keeping an eye on?
Let me actually go back to the summary of benefits and coverage form just for a moment. Inside that form, which displays traditional health plan information in a consumer-friendly way, deductible and so on, it also includes something new that consumers have never seen before, which is called a coverage example. And a coverage example shows for the health plan, what would it pay for a standard medical scenario? And the first two scenarios are having a baby and a year's worth of treatment for, I think it's type 2 diabetes. In our testing, these proved incredibly innovative. They really changed the conversation for consumers with respect to, A, how much coverage am I getting under this plan, but it also reminded them that insurance is valuable. Look, I'm paying all these dollars down here, but the health plan is also paying money on my behalf. And believe it or not, it actually, in our testing, it reversed the decision of consumers in terms of whether or not they would purchase a given health plan. That's one of those little innovations that may actually prove to be very powerful in terms of a better functioning insurance market and better informed consumers.
We've been speaking today with Lynn Quincy, Senior Policy Analyst for Health Reform at Consumers Union, the Policy and Advocacy Branch of Consumer Reports, a nonprofit independent organization dedicated to protecting consumers in this country. Lynn, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
I'm Arianna O'Hare with this tech report. Life is imitating art, and it could end up saving lives. When Horatio Caine is cracking cases on CSI Miami, he has a lot of help in the field with the latest equipment.
Somebody sabotaged his chute.
This is a crime.
Take a look at these suspension lines. They look burnt.
A field machine that's been used artistically in CSI Miami to do instant fingerprint analysis in the field has inspired a new set of tools in the medical theater that will greatly facilitate neurosurgeons during brain surgery or help regulate exact doses for chemotherapy patients who often suffer the effects of toxicity. At the recent national meeting of the American Chemical Society, Dr. Graham Cooks of Purdue University and his team unveiled two new instruments they developed based on the CSI model that can do almost instant pathology on tissue. The Desorption Electrospray Ionization Mass Spectrometer, or DESI for short. While Cook's students have used the DESI in such portable settings as analyzing chemicals on fruit in grocery stores, Cook's is teaming up with Harvard researchers to test its efficacy in the OR. Cook says it's particularly exciting for doing instant tissue analysis during brain surgery, rather than waiting sometimes hours for pathology reports while a patient's skull is open.
During those surgeries, biopsies may be taken and they will be looked at by the standard pathology methods. Those methods are less informative than they might be, and this experiment gives you a great deal of information on the chemicals.
The DESI can detect the kind of cancer that may be present, instantly informing doctors about treatments moving forward.
And so from that mass spectrum, you can in fact get the type of tumor. You can also determine the cell density and you can determine the grade. And so all of that information helps complement standard pathology methods.
The other instrument they unveiled, the paper spray ionization mass spectrometer, can determine levels of chemotherapy drugs in patients' blood in real time, which can help clinicians give more accurate doses to patients. From the imaginings of a popular crime show creator to helping physicians save lives in the real-life surgical theater, could be poised to improve the outcomes for brain tumor patients as well as those on chemotherapy. Even Horatio Caine would have to be impressed. I'm Marianne O'Hare with this tech report.
If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter or would like to subscribe to the podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of Connecting Our Communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.